Graduation. Maury died on a Saturday morning. His immediate family was with him in the house. Rob made it in from Tokyo. He got to kiss his father goodbye. And John was there, and of course Charlotte, and Charlotte's cousin Marcia, who had written the poem that so moved Maury at his unofficial memorial service, the poem that likened him to a tender sequoia. They slept in shifts around his bed. Maury had fallen into a coma 2 days after our final visit, and the doctor said he could go at any moment. Instead, he hung on, through a tough afternoon, through a dark night. Finally, on the 4th of November, when those he loved had left the room just for a moment to grab coffee in the kitchen, the first time none of them were with him since the coma began, Maury stopped breathing, and he was gone. I believe he died this way on purpose. I believe he wanted no chilling moments, no one to witness his last breath and be haunted by it, the way he had been haunted by his mother's death notice telegram or by his father's corpse in the city morgue. I believe he knew that he was in his own bed, that his books and his notes and his small hibiscus plant were nearby. He wanted to go serenely, and that is how he went. The funeral was held on a damp, windy morning. The grass was wet and the sky was the color of milk. We stood by the hole in the earth, close enough to hear the pond water lapping against the edge and to see ducks shaking off their feathers. Although hundreds of people had wanted to attend, Charlotte kept this gathering small, just a few close friends and relatives. Rabbi Axelrod read a few poems. Maury's brother David, who still walked with a limp from his childhood polio, lifted the shovel and tossed dirt into the grave, as per tradition. At one point, when Maury's ashes were placed into the ground, I glanced around the cemetery. Maury was right. It was indeed a lovely place. Trees and grass and a sloping hill. "You talk, I'll listen," he had said. I tried doing that in my head, and to my happiness, found that the imagined conversation felt almost natural. I looked down at my hands, saw my watch, and realized why. It was Tuesday. My father moved through days of we, singing each new leaf out of each tree, and every child was sure that spring danced when she heard my father sing. A poem by E.E. Cummings, read by Maury's son Rob at the funeral service. Conclusion. I look back sometimes at the person I was before I rediscovered my old professor. I want to talk to that person. I want to tell him what to look out for, what mistakes to avoid. I want to tell him to be more open, to ignore the lure of advertised values, to pay attention when your loved ones are speaking, as if it were the last time you might hear them. Mostly, I want to tell that person to get on an airplane and visit a gentle old man in West Newton, Massachusetts, sooner rather than later, before that old man gets sick and loses his ability to dance. I know I cannot do this. None of us can undo what we've done or relive a life already recorded. But if Professor Morris Schwartz taught me anything at all, it was this. There is no such thing as too late in life. He was changing until the day he said goodbye. Not long after Maury's death, I reached my brother in Spain. We had a long talk. I told him I respected his distance and that all I wanted was to be in touch, in the present, not just the past, to hold him in my life as much as he could let me. "You're my only brother," I said. "I don't want to lose you. I love you." I had never said such a thing to him before. A few days later, I received a message on my fax machine. It was typed in the sprawling, poorly punctuated, all-cap letters fashion that always characterized my brother's words. "Hi, I've joined the 90s, it began. He wrote a few little stories, what he'd been doing that week, and a couple of jokes. At the end, he signed off this way: "I have heartburn and diarrhea at the moment. Life's a bitch. Chat later. Signed, Sore Tush." I laughed until there were tears in my eyes. This book was largely Maury's idea. He called it our final thesis. Like the best of work projects, it brought us closer together, and Maury was delighted when several publishers expressed interest, even though he died before meeting any of them. The advance money helped pay Maury's enormous medical bills, and for that, we were both grateful. The title, by the way, we came up with one day in Maury's office. He liked naming things. He had several ideas. But when I said, "How about Tuesdays with Maury?" he smiled in an almost blushing way, and I knew that was it. After Maury died, I went through boxes of old college material, and I discovered a final paper I had written for one of his classes. It was 20 years old now. On the front page were my penciled comments scribbled to Maury, and beneath them were his comments scribbled back. Mine began, "Dear Coach." His began, "Dear Player." For some reason, each time I read that, I miss him even more. Have you ever really had a teacher? One who saw you as a raw but precious thing, a jewel that with wisdom could be polished to a proud shine? If you're lucky enough to find your way to such teachers, you will always find your way back. Sometimes it's only in your head. Sometimes it's right alongside their beds. He looked at me. The last class of my old professor's life took place once a week in his home by a window in his study where he could watch a small hibiscus plant shed its pink flowers. The class met on Tuesdays. No books were required. The subject was the meaning of life. It was taught from experience. The teaching goes on.